The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Where would you like to go in the world here? So we're in the Himalayas, I think. Is there another place?
Let's go someplace warm.
Okay, someplace warm, okay. All right, let's go someplace warm. Chattanooga's warm. Let's go to Hawaii. Is that all right? Is that all right? Or Easter Island or somewhere like that? All right, let's see. Now, we'll go down to Hawaii. All right. Belize is a possibility. Hawaii. We all know it's warm there. Okay. Okay, where? You want to go to Waikiki? You want to go to Waikiki Beach?
Sure.
Okay, we'll go to Waikiki. All right, there we go. Yeah, there you go. Let's see. That's where I served up for that. But this is a terrible beach, you know. The sand is okay. The sand is great. But you get out in the water and it's nothing but rock. You know, awful. But I love Hawaii. Okay. All right. So, let's see here. Got supplemental. I've got... Okay, you're still under introduction. Okay. As soon as I find my... Okay, so here's the last piece then in the intro, to let you know, because we're understanding the Islamic challenge, okay? And, so this is just the last little piece. This is the newest thing I put in there. All right. Okay, so World War IV has begun, okay? And that's the nature of the challenge we're in. I mean, you know, when we talk about, remember how Bush, well, he may not remember this, but during Gulf War I, George H.W. Bush said, we are now in a new world order. Now, I don't know if some of y'all remember. So this is the new world disorder. Okay? All right. So it's just a way of looking at it. And you see, what I'm saying here is, and again, remember the axioms I gave you, okay? Remember the axioms I gave you. All right. So you ask, you know, we talk about World War IV. What was World War III? World War III was a Cold War. Okay, it was a Cold War. And it was a war. Okay, World War III was the Cold War. It was a global struggle between the United States and its Western allies, right? And, Sam, do you have a World War IV? You should have it. Oh, in the next stuff.
I have the Life of Muhammad next.
Unbelievable. Okay. Well, just play along, and I'll make sure you get it. When you get the book, I'll make sure you get it. Okay, okay, all right. Okay, it was
a struggle between. That's gonna be a real interesting experience for me.
Oh yeah, I hear that. Yeah, I try to bring enough stuff up, but okay. It was a war between the United States and its Western allies, the Soviet Union, and the Communist bloc. Okay, 46 years. Of a struggle, okay? There you go. And it dominated world events. 46 years, it dominated world events. So World War III was a real war. It was a real war. All right. So, now, just to understand, you know, here are the opening events of the Cold War, of World War III. The Yalta Conference of Franklin Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill, February 1945. That's where it became apparent that the Allied forces arrayed against Germany were going to fight among themselves, okay? The second opening event, Winston Churchill delivers his Iron Curtain speech at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri. He says, from the Adriatics in the north to Trieste in the south, an Iron Curtain has descended over the continent. And from that day on, everybody talked about, you know, the Soviet bloc as the Iron Curtain. I used to wonder when I was young, hear people talk about the Iron Curtain, and thought, I couldn't imagine that, you know? You know how when you're a kid, Iron Curtain, you know? I used to hear songs like, I've got you under my skin. I said, oh, how... And then, I don't know. Then I was beginning to learn about the cosmos, you know, the stars and the planets and Earth. So I was like, I got the world on a string, sitting on the rainbow. I thought, well, what kind of cosmology is that? I don't know. You can think back on some things like that. You know, the Iron Curtain, that thing used to bother me. How in the world do you have an Iron Curtain? Okay, so he delivers that speech in March of 1946. Then the Marshall Plan is announced. Of course, you know, it's essentially to blunt the advance of communism. June 1947. The communists take over in Czechoslovakia, February 1948. The Berlin blockade begins. June of 1948, and the NATO treaty is ratified on April 4th, 1949. Those are the opening events of the Cold War. Of course, NATO. See the, you know, you see the tit for tat here. Okay, so NATO then becomes a mutual defense pact between, so they're trying to prevent. Okay, now check this out. MAD deterred the Cold War from erupting into an all-out hot war. That's why, you know, you don't think of the Cold War as a war, but the thing that kept it from being an all-out war was MAD. Okay? Mutually assured destruction. So the Soviets knew that if they vaporized any of our cities, we'd vaporize theirs. And that kept the thing at bay, you know, right? Yeah. MAD.
True.
Okay. That's the only reason why. Now, of course, that didn't prevent the Soviets and the Americans from fighting wars with each other, you know, using surrogates. You know what I'm saying? But that's what prevented. So it was a war, but if it had ever erupted into an all-out war, that would have been the end of everything anyway. Okay, all of the things were evil. Okay, the closing events of the Cold War. Hungary becomes independent, September 1989. The Berlin Wall falls, November 1989. The communist governments fall in Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, and Romania, December 1989. You see what's going on here? These are the closing events of the Cold War. Now, I'm putting this up here because we got to understand, using this as a rubric, then let's look at World War IV. Got it? I'm getting ready to go and compare. We're looking at the Cold War. We're getting ready to compare World War II and World War IV. Okay. All right. Germany reunited, October 1990. Warsaw Pact falls apart, April 1991. And then finally, the Soviet Union collapses, August of 1991. That's when the collapse of the Soviet Union was announced, when Gorbachev came and said, I now step down from my position as Premier of the Soviet Union, because there was no more Soviet Union anyway. Okay, so those are the closing events of the Cold War. And it was a war. It was a war. It was a war. Okay, so now we talk about, today we are embroiled in a war on terrorism. Radical Muslims have declared war on Western civilization. Now, we as Christians should also be at war with Western civilization, okay? But we should be at war with Western civilization because Western civilization has turned away from what created it, namely, you know, the biblical world and life view, a biblical world and life view, all right? Now, please don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that Western civilization is the end-all and be-all of everything. But some good things came out of it. However, terrorism is neither a philosophy nor an ideology. It's just a tactic of warfare. So to say we're involved in a war on terrorism is not really a war on terrorism. because terrorism is just a tactic. The ideology behind most of today's terrorism is Islamofascism. Now, I know that's a politically incorrect term, but maybe another term could be jihadism. Maybe jihadism, okay? But Islamofascism. They are going to impose their beliefs on us, whether we want to, okay? All right. So, that's the war here. So World War IV is a global struggle between the Islamofascists, whose goal is to create a worldwide Islamic empire, and you will hear this several times. I think even the video says this. And this is what they're trying to do. They want to create a worldwide Islamic empire. Now, I can show you some maps and stuff and what the plans are. I can show you that the general, the Shiites have their strategy of how to do this. The Sunnis have their strategy of how to do this. But that's what they want to do. They want to create a worldwide Islamic empire. And the other side are non-Muslim civilizations. All right, whether the Western or non-Western. And that's how it's really coming down to. But we are rapidly sliding into a bipolar world, just like we were back during the days of the Cold War. But this time, this is a much more treacherous and much more dangerous type of warfare. Now watch this. Unlike the Cold War, MAD has no deterrent effect. That's the difference. That's why this thing is so dangerous. MAD has no deterrent effect. Because we're dealing with two completely alien value systems here. So, when we talk about Islam, this is what we're talking about. Now, some people say, well, we're not fighting Islam, we're fighting terrorism. Well, we're not fighting Muslims. But in a sense, we are fighting Islam. Okay. We'll get into that in a little bit. Check this out. What are we looking at? We in the West value life. Okay? And guess what? The Islamofascists value death. If Mahmoud Ahmadinejad gets the nukes, he will use them. No question about it. He will use them. And anybody who thinks differently is stupid. So you might say, well, what if he uses them? Isn't he going to get vaporized? Isn't Tehran going to be vaporized and all that? Yes. You talk to a suicide bomber. If you go and blow up the bomb and destroy those soldiers over there, you're going to die. What's he going to say? Allahu Akbar! That's the point. We got to understand that guys like Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, he thinks like a suicide bomber. Because you see, in Islam, there is no assurance of salvation. Is not even the assurance that Allah will say the same things today as He said yesterday. And the only chance that a Muslim has of assurance of salvation is to die in the jihad, in the holy war. Now, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, he's a true believer. He thinks, and see, the problem with the West is that we don't take religion seriously. We don't think religiously. Now, if we can think religiously, then we can understand Ahmadinejad. We can understand him very easily. You got the head of the Foreign Relations Committee down in Washington doesn't know the difference between a Sunni and a Shiite. Now, what kind of mess is that? Anyway, praise God. Don't give me the priest now. Okay. Okay. Hold on. Oh, All right. So what? See, again, we as Christians, we can think religiously. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, okay, let me give you the deal on this. I'm jumping ahead of myself. But in the Shiite faith, they've had these. There have been these 12 imams. The imam in the Shiite thing is kind of like the pope in a way, you know. Okay, and the 12th imam, several hundred years ago, disappeared. See, but he's going to come back. His name was Mahdi something or other. Anyway, he's going to come back in the end days when chaos reigns. You see. Well, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad believes that the 12th imam is on the verge of coming back. He's already here, and he says he'll be revealed here in this year, 2007. Okay. But in order for him to come back, there's got to be great chaos in the world, you see. So he's going to go do his best to create the chaos so the Mahdi can come back. That's like the Messiah figure, all right? He's thinking like that, and he's a true believer. But see, we in the West, you see, we think, oh, separation of mosque and state. They don't think like that. Okay. All right. So now let's look at the parallels between World War II and World War IV. All right. And here's the deal. World War IV has begun, but unfortunately, we in the non-Muslim world have not taken this thing seriously, and we haven't put ourselves on a war footing. Okay, World War II. Hitler's troops occupy the Rhineland. March 7, 1936. What was the response from Europe? None. All right, World War IV. Al-Qaeda operatives carry out the first World Trade Center bombing in New York City, February 26, 1993. What response?
Nothing.
None. No response from America. All right. Well, what else? Hitler takes over Austria, March 1938. No response from Europe. Hezbollah, Al-Azaz operatives bomb the Khobar Towers in the Khobar, Saudi Arabia, June 1996. What? No response from America. World War II. Hitler's troops occupy the Sudetenland. Czech government resigns, October 1938. No response from Europe. World War IV. Al-Qaeda operatives bomb the U.S. embassies in Nairobi, Kenya, and Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, August 1998. Ineffective response from America. So what do we do? We bomb a pharmaceutical plant. And some abandoned camps up in Afghanistan with our high-tech cruise missiles. So I think we killed the gopher or two. Okay. All right. World War II. Hitler takes over Czechoslovakia. 1939. March 1939. No response from Europe. Al-Qaeda operatives bombed the USS Cole while harboring the enemy fort of Aden, October 2000. What? No response from America. Now, all this time, Hitler's been going on. He's just taking a boom, 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 boom. Hitler just keeps going. And if Europe didn't do anything, Hitler would have just kept going. Al-Qaeda the same way. All right. Now, let's go back to World War II. Okay. Hitler's troops invade Poland, September 1, 1939. Now all of a sudden everybody gets upset, right? So, France, Britain, Australia, and New Zealand declare war on Germany, September 1939. World War II begins. Okay? All right. Well, what about World War IV? All right. Okay, we bring the World War and then move it over. Put the six there. There you go. All right. All right. Al-Qaeda operatives, 19 Al-Qaeda operatives hijack four passenger jets. You know the story. Use these planes as weapons. They destroy the World Trade Center in New York. They heavily damage the Pentagon near Washington, D.C., September 11, 2001. And guess what? A multinational coalition of 37 countries led by the United States mobilizes against Al-Qaeda and those who harbor them, the Taliban rulers of Afghanistan. World War IV begins. Now, we are in World War IV, but somehow, let me say something here. I'm not a Republican, and I'm not a Democrat, I'm not a liberal and I'm not a conservative, all right? Is that clear? That's my disclaimer, all right? But some of these idiots think that they can negotiate with these guys. You understand what I'm saying? But you can't negotiate with these guys. The only thing you can, the only thing that they understand is strength. Remember when the United States, now again, whatever you think of the war in Iraq, that's, you know, I'm not going to get into that. But last year, when our Marines went in there and took Fallujah, remember that? Remember how bad Fallujah was? I mean, they had these guys pinned down. I mean, it was just about over. You know? Then all of a sudden they said, let's negotiate! And we stood down and negotiated for humanitarian reasons. Okay? That's a Western way of thinking, right? But you know how, do you know how the insurgents look at it? You know what
Time to reload.
Time to reload. But they saw it as weakness. You understand what I'm saying? We should have just gone on and just... Now, look, I'm not a violent guy, but I understand how they think. Okay. All right. But see, we got people in Washington right now who are thinking that if we do something nice, they'll do something nice in return. That's just a bunch of poppycock. That's not the way they think. All right. So we're up against Islamofascism. Now, let me kind of frame this thing a little bit. Remember the axioms I told earlier? Remember the axioms, okay? But let me kind of frame this thing a little bit. Most Muslims in the world, the overwhelming majority of Muslims in the world, are peace-loving, wonderful folks, okay? Great people, okay? Most Muslims, 90% plus, okay? So there are many moderate, peace-loving Muslim, okay, got it? But there is no such thing as a moderate, peace-loving Islam. I'll just put it that way. Does that make sense? Okay. All right. So that's what we're looking at. But these folks understand what it is, and they're out to dominate and create a worldwide Muslim empire. And you know what? They kind of remind me. Now, just think. Think of Jeremiah. Jeremiah is prophesying away. And the kind of things he was saying things like, God's going to hand y'all over to Osama bin Laden. Yeah. You understand? Doesn't that make your blood boil if somebody told you that? God is on bin Laden's side. That's kind of what his stuff sounded like today. And I think in a very real way. I'm not saying Western civilization is the people of God or anything else like that. But what I'm saying is that Western civilization has turned its back on what brought it forth in the first place. Namely, biblical theism. Theism in general, biblical theism in particular. And then the church is just goofing around and we're not doing a whole lot. And so I think in a very real sense, and we're looking at the consequences of, neglecting what the blessings that God has given us. Okay, so
are you saying that the minority of Muslims,
yeah,
are actually practicing Islam?
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying. Bin Laden, Muqtada al-Sadr, and people of their ilk, their only sin, from a Muslim point of view, their only sin is that they're good Muslims. Islam, in its essence, is not a peaceful religion. It is violent, intolerant, militaristic. And these guys, these terrorist guys, they are the true believers. And we're fortunate that most Muslims are not good Muslims. Okay. Yes?
I just don't know. Just to be candid here, I think I backed off saying something. I sounded like that a few years ago, and I'd really like you to interact with me on this. I'm not trying to be a jerk here at all.
No.
I backed off that because of this, because reading the Quran, and like you said earlier, there's contradictions in the Quran.
Right.
And I came to the conclusion to be consistent in my criticism of Islam. I couldn't believe really in an essence of Islam. The same way we look at biblical Christianity, we see that there is a unified voice in Scripture. There is a true Christianity we're all striving for. But when we look at Islam, a cacophony of voices are there in the Quran. I thought to be consistent, I can't say a true Islam. So therefore, I couldn't look at the jihadists and say, now they're truly Islamic. I came to the conclusion where I had to say, hey, you make up your own Islam. You choose your verses. You abrogate whatever you want to do. Is that a little fairer critique? That's the point where I'm at, rather than saying those jihadists are the right
truth. Well, no, that's a noble attempt. But if you understand the doctrine of abrogation, I can put it out there very clearly for you, and it would make all the sense in the world. If you understand abrogation, it's not up to the individual to abrogate stuff. The Quran abrogates. So, you know, let Scripture interpret Scripture, let Quran interpret Quran, okay? And if you look at the system in and of itself, see, most Muslims don't know about abrogation, you see? So, but those who do, we know which ones, we know pretty much what's been abrogated. The Muslim scholars know.
I think you're right. I think it goes down to that point. I guess I came to the conclusion that abrogation, the way I was hearing it, it seemed to be orthodox, but not everyone grabbed on. Not everyone
Not everyone
subscribes to it. There again, I think, well, then Islam is fractured in its very core.
Well, not only all people who call themselves Christians necessarily subscribe to the what? The
Apostles' Creed.
Yeah, the Apostles' Creed or something. You know, no, not the Apostles. That's just too fundamental, but. Not all people who call themselves Christians subscribe to an inerrant scripture. Let's put it that way.
So, yeah, right. I know, but I guess I'm saying, not from a sociological perspective, that you're right, there's fractured Christianity.
Right.
But I mean from a consistent apologetics perspective, we still know scripture speaks with one voice.
Right.
But
Quran doesn't speak with one. No,
we don't believe about the Quran. So just from a consistent apologetics perspective, don't we have to say then, if the Quran doesn't speak with one voice, there is no true Islam. So how can we say...
We can say that if there wasn't an Islamic doctrine of abrogation.
Okay, so it really goes back. Okay.
But there is an Islamic doctrine of abrogation, which I'll get into in a little bit. And so I know what you're saying.
That's helpful.
So I'm gonna go according to their doctrine, you know. And again, probably most Muslims in the world don't know about that, okay? Because of another fundamental doctrine in Islam called the doctrine of deception, which we'll get into later on. So, all right. I appreciate that. Okay, and you'll understand. Let me give you a quote. You'll understand it better by and by. Okay. Okay. All right.
While you're pulling that up, can I just ask, do they really call it the doctrine of deception, or do they have a fancy fuzzy?
It's called that. It's called that. But again, now, okay. Parentheses. Never let a Muslim know that you know about abrogation. More deception. Never let them know. Unless it comes up from them. They bring it up and then you can get into it. Okay?
Why?
Okay.
Yeah,
well, because... Okay. You're looking at 18. You're at the blackjack table. You're looking at 18 and you pick the whole card, you got a 3. You gonna let everybody know you got a 3? No, I raise you 1,000. I see you 1,000. I'm raise you 10,000. You understand what I'm saying? We're talking about not be. See, don't let them know because you want to know. You want to be on the high road here. You know what I'm saying? You know their stuff. They don't know your stuff. You know, and that gives you the upper hand. You can tell them if you want to. But then they'll start denying it. Oh, there's no such thing, you know. That's just a bunch of baloney, you know. They know that there is such a thing, but of course they feel free to tell you that it isn't because it can't because of the doctrine of deception. You're an infidel, you don't deserve the truth anyway. You know what I'm saying? They have deniability, but just don't let them know. Let that be one of those things that gives you wisdom, and they start coming at you with all this nice, warm, fuzzy stuff. You know what's going on. Either they believe it, and they have been deceived, or they don't believe it and they're trying to deceive you. Okay? And yeah, but it's true. There is a cacophony of voices. As a matter of fact, Allah Himself has a cacophony of truth or whatever, or a lie. I mean, you know, today's truth can be tomorrow's lie. You just don't know. You have no idea what the heck is going on with Allah. And which makes me wonder, how on earth can one leave Christianity, salvation by grace, for that? What does that say about how people perceive Christianity? You know? Okay.
Question.
Yeah.
You presented almost as a big insider secret that doctrine of deception or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
How can the Muslims who know be naive enough to believe that no one outside the Muslim community knows about it?
They don't really necessarily believe that nobody outside the community knows about it, but it's just that they don't want to reveal that. They want to keep that as their hold card. You know, as a matter of fact, first time I ever heard about abrogation. Can I tell you the context? Okay, this is my one time I backslid. Okay, I use evidentiary apologetics. All right. For that I have repented. Okay. One day, I was trying to show this guy, you know, I make it my policy never, I don't use the Quran as a part of my witness to a Muslim, okay, because I know I don't understand it the way they do. You know, Muslims try to use the Bible to witness to me, so they say that Jesus predicted the coming of Muhammad. Yeah, Jesus predicted the coming of Muhammad. By the way, I think that's on a final somewhere. But anyway, and of course that's false, you know, right? But they say, oh, no, yeah, he did. And then they point out where Jesus says, I'm sending another comforter. Yeah. And that refers to Muhammad. Well, that ticked me off. Because I know that's not it. So if I try to use Quranic verses that say Jesus is the word of God, you know, or Jesus is the spirit of God or something like that, like, see? Well, that'll tick them off because they understand that in a completely different way. You know what I'm saying? So I just don't do it. Now, I know Christians who do that. To each his own. But anyway, I was talking to this guy. Said, oh, your Bible's corrupted. It's corrupt. I said, what do you mean it's corrupt? It's just corrupt. See? All right. I said, well, okay. I said, well, Muhammad appealed to the Bible to verify what he was doing. He said, well, I said, well, you know, was the Bible corrupt at that time? He said, no, no. I said, oh, okay. All right. So theoretically then, you could say, and at one time, you know, at one time, our oldest manuscript was called the what? At one time? Even earlier, you know. Say, back in 1900, the oldest, or maybe 100 years ago. Or no, that's not the other. No, the Textus Receptus, you remember?
Yeah.
At one time, that was our oldest manuscript, dated back to the 11th century, is that right? Okay? So, if the Bible is corrupt, theoretically, the corruption then had to have occurred sometimes after the 7th century and before the 11th century, right? And I'm explaining this. I'm feeling pretty good about myself.
Yeah,
I got it to agree.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, now, so we got manuscripts and fragments that date all the way back to the 2nd century. You know, I think our oldest whole New Testament is 4th century. Is that right? Something like that. We got stuff that goes back before the time of Muhammad. And we compare that with the Textus Receptus, and there was no problem. I mean, you know, little stuff, you know, but nothing of substance. I said, so therefore, I said, if the Bible's corrupt, then the corruption had to come before the time of Muhammad. And if that's the case, then your prophet is appealing to a corrupted source, which puts his prophethood into question. You know, a little bit of presuppositionalism there, right? He said, okay. He said, okay, the Bible then, I agree then. I come around to your thing. The Bible is not corrupted. I said, great. Are you ready to receive Jesus? He said, oh no. He said, it doesn't matter anyway. See, it doesn't matter. Because even if the Bible was true at one time, it doesn't matter because it's been abrogated. I said, whoa. And that's the first time I heard that. I thought, my goodness, I didn't even know about that. So I had to do some digging around, and I found out that that was true. That the doctrine of abrogation is true. You know, that's one of their fun. See, they ain't going to tell you that. Because if they tell you that, if they tell the world that, then the world's going to know that. See, that eliminates a tool of theirs. They're going to come along and share these nice, warm, fuzzy verses. You know, there's no compulsion in religion and all that, to show you how nice and moderate Islam is. But if you know that stuff has been abrogated, then you're going to say, hey, I don't accept that. But they want you to accept it. I was at a meeting, check this out, in Dallas about a month ago. And at this meeting were some muckety-mucks in the federal government, right? These were advisors to the president and all that. So, about 1,500 people there. And they were saying, oh yes, Islam, it's a part of the Abrahamic tradition, and we shouldn't be so afraid. Oh, and you got the moderate Muslims, and we must strengthen them against the radicals and all that. Yeah, Islam is really a peaceful religion. It's okay. I'm thinking, oh, brother. So I got up, and I said, how am I going to... I was asked to give a presentation, so I got up and broke down the doctrine of abrogation and the doctrine of deception. And I said, you can tell the abrogated verses, abrogated service, because they start off by saying, so-and-so. You know, so. And so so what I did, these guys, I was being presuppositional there, right? I totally undercut what these other guys were saying. Just totally, you know, they were saying all this lofty stuff, but I just told them what was going on here. And then we got into the panel, and they said, well, see, the Muslim, the Quran itself, is on our side, because it says blah 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 blah, and it started off exactly the way, you know, exactly the abrogated surah started off exactly that way, and so everybody knew, oh wow, you know, you know, and so it was an interesting thing. I just kind of just cut right to the chase, and but that's what we're looking at. I mean, please don't get me wrong. I'm not an I'm not into Islamophobia or anything else like that, and I'm not trying to. I find it very difficult to say what I say because I know and love a number of Muslims, you know. And I say things like this here because I'm here at Westminster. Now, if I'm at, you know, Masjid Muhammad or something, you know what I mean, in a dialogue, I'm not going to be lying. I'm going to use a whole lot more finesse, you know what I'm saying. But, anyway. Yeah.
Sorry, just because I missed the first here. Can you just say very briefly what abrogation is?
Okay. I'm really getting ahead of myself, you know. I'm going to talk more about it. But suffice it to say, this is the simple version, the simple deal of it. Muhammad, you know, the Quran is a collection of the recitations of Muhammad. Okay? Okay. But there are contradictions between some of these recitations. And so what the Muslims say is when there is a contradiction, the one that was recited last overrides the one that was recited earlier. The one that was recited earlier is abrogated. Okay. All right. Then they apply that then. So they believe that the Bible, you know, came and the Quran came from the same source. But so they not only will the last one abrogate the earlier one inside the Quran, but the later, quote, revelation abrogates the earlier one in the Bible if there's a contradiction. Okay. All right. Okay, let's go over the life of Muhammad real quick, and then we'll have some. Okay. The context, that's the hood. Okay, that's where Muhammad kicked it. Okay. Okay, all right. So what's going on in the time? This is the 6th century, you know. Muhammad was born in and raised in Mecca, and there were a number of tribes. There were a number of tribes in the Arabian Peninsula, and all of them had different gods. Okay, and these gods kind of had a pecking order. Of course, the highest of the gods was the moon god, and they would refer to him often as Al-Ilah, or contraction Allah. Okay, now. Allah doesn't mean the moon god. Allah is just merely the Arabic word for God, okay? So, the largest and most influential tribe on the Arabian Peninsula was the Quraysh tribe. That was Muhammad's tribe. Okay. Now, in the middle of Mecca, there was this cubicle building, which still stands today. And in this building, all the 360-some-odd gods that were worshipped by all these tribes were housed in that building. And so each of the tribes would make their pilgrimage to Mecca to worship their gods every year. All right? So, by the way, let me give you a little history here. The god that the Quraysh tribe worshiped is the same god that was worshiped by Belshazzar. And Nabonidus. Remember? Nabonidus. And remember, see, Daniel had one time been, you know, he was appointed Secretary of Theological Education for all of Babylon, right? Mm-hmm. And he instituted the Danielic curriculum, right? Mm-hmm. All right, so when Nebuchadnezzar dies, there's a coup d'etat. Well, no, his son takes over. There's a coup d'etat, right? Right? And Daniel was kind of forced into retirement. And then, so the general who takes over, he dies, and his son takes over. Then there's a coup from that. Nabonidus takes it. He gets sick. He goes on to the Arabian Peninsula. And, of course, he's running things from the south, and Belshazzar's running things from the north. And what they were doing, they were trying to de-Danielize the theological curriculum, right? And so they finally totally tried to wipe out everything that Daniel had done. And to celebrate the completion of that, they decided to drink toast to their gods out of the goblets, remember? And of course, and so the god that they worship, the highest god in that system was Nana, which is the same thing as the same god that was worshipped by the tribe. And you know what happens. They start drinking these toasts, and there's writing on the wall. And let me put it in a British vernacular, what happened to Belshazzar. Let me put it in British vernacular. When he saw the handwriting on the walls, he got scared and soiled his trousers. Okay, praise God. Okay, all right. You can kind of put two and two together on that. Okay, all right. So, a lot of things were happening and so on and so on. Now, another thing that came into play was there were two superpowers of the day. One was the Byzantine Empire, okay, and the other was the Sassanid Empire. Of course, you know who these guys were. If you know anything about religious history, you know the Byzantines were kind of Christians in name only, right? They were kind of ruthless. And the Sassanids were what would now be the Iranians. But if you know anything about history, you know that in Persia, you had this corrupt religious system, these corrupt priests called Magi, and that's where we get magic from, by the way, and they were just corrupt, and they had a chokehold on society, and then there was a revolution led by a guy named Zoroaster. Remember that? Zoroaster was kind of a monotheist, and that electrified the Persians, and they got strong, they conquered Babylon and all that kind of stuff, but eventually the Magi had a counter-revolution, and they back over, they threw the Zoroastrians out. And then in the 3rd century, the gospel was rambling across Iran, and the Sassanid dynasty said, we got to do something to stop this. So they went into their own history and said, oh, we got a god who used to preach, talk about one god. So they reconstituted that, and I call it Neo-Zoroastrianism. It wasn't monotheistic, it was dualistic. Okay, so that's where these guys were at. They were Neo-Zoroastrian. These guys were pagan Christians, I guess, or apostate Christians. Anyway, so to make a long story short, these two superpowers were acting like the United States and Soviet Union. They were fighting wars between each other by way of surrogate forces, the tribes. Okay, so there was a lot of chaos in the Arabian Peninsula, to say the least. All right, so that's where we are. That's the situation in which Muhammad was born. So now let's move that map on over, and we'll talk about a couple of incidents in his life. Okay, first of all, Muhammad was born in Mecca in AD 70. Now, before his birth, his mom was named Amina, and his father had his long name, Mutalib, Zaiban, something. I got to get back with that. But his father was on a business trip up to Damascus, and on his way back, this is before Muhammad was born. By the time he fell ill on the journey back, and then he got back to Medina, and that's where he died. He never saw his son. So Muhammad then was born. His father had already died, AD 70. All right. Well, he was taken in by his grandfather. His mom died, 6 years later, right? So now he's an orphan, and then his grandfather took him in, but he died 2 years later. So by the time Muhammad was eight, he didn't have his father at the beginning. He lost his mom, and he lost his grandfather. All right, so then after that, he was taken in by his poverty-stricken uncle, who had 13 kids of his own. Okay? 13 kids of his own. And so Muhammad kind of had to raise himself, okay? Now, there's a couple of things that came out about Muhammad, and that is, one, two things that came out about him as he grew. One, he was very attractive to women. He just attracted women, okay? And the second thing is that he became very astute at entrepreneurial stuff. You know, he was very good at business things. All right. There was this rich widow around. Her name was Khadija. And she ran a caravan business, believe it or not. Khadija Caravan Lines or something or other, whatever. Anyway, so she was a rich widow. She was 40 years old, and she met Muhammad when he was 25, and she hired him to run her business. And the business did okay. And a few months later, she said, he make a good husband. So she proposed, he accepted. So in the year 595 AD, Muhammad married Khadija. She was 15 years his senior. Okay? All right. Well, now Muhammad is kind of a wealthy guy. You know, he's doing all right. He has time to meditate and stuff like that. He'd go out to the mountains and think about things, and about issues of the day and all the rest of that. Well, to make a long story short, 15 years later, Muhammad is 40. He goes out in one of these meditative periods and falls into a cold sweat. He did it before James Brown. I break out. Okay. In a cold sweat. Okay. So anyway, he fell into a cold sweat. He went into a trance, and he heard this being say, Quran, recite. And Muhammad said, I will not recite. And just then, he felt himself being choked. The voice again said, recite! And Muhammad said, I will not recite. The choking became much stronger, so much so that he felt his life ebbing away. And the voice again said, recite! And Muhammad said, what shall I recite? Okay. And then these words came out of his mouth. Does anybody have a Quran here by chance? Okay. Look up Surah 96, verses 1 through 5, if you can find it. If not, I don't know if that has the verse markings or whatever. Surah 96, verses 1 through 5. And it says, recite in the name of thy Lord, etc. Can you read it for us? That may have a different set of a different verse thing. Yeah, that's it.
Recite in the name of your Lord who created man from clots of blood. Recite, your Lord is the most bountiful one, who by the pen taught man what he did not know, Indeed, man transgresses in thinking himself his own master, for to your Lord all things return. Observe the man who rebukes our servant when he prays. Think, does he follow the right guidance or enjoin true piety? Think, if he denies the truth and pays no heed, does he not realize that God observes all? No. Let him desist, or we will drag him by the forelock, his lying sinful forelock. Then let him call his helpmates. We will call the guards of hell. No, never obey him. Prostrate yourself and come nearer.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, that was the first recitation. That was the very first recitation. Now, all that came out. And Muhammad came to, and he saw this horrendous, horrible, scary, frightening looking being, and it scared him to death. And he turned away, but every time he turned, no matter how he turned, the being was right there. And he just lost it. He ran, he fled, he ran home, he burst into the house and said, "Cover me, cover me, I think I've been called to be a Kahin." Kahin was a soothsayer. Muhammad was so scared. He thought he had encountered Satan himself or some powerful demon. I mean, she tried to comfort him and console him. She said, no, it's terrible. So, eventually, in all of the stress, he just fell asleep. So she went to see a relative of hers, a cousin to be exact. And she didn't tell him the whole story, right? So he suggested that perhaps she had an encounter with God. Well, she came back to the house, and there he was again in another trance, reciting, blah, 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 blah. And he came to, and she told him the news, but he didn't go for it. He was full of fears and doubts. And so, for the next 6 months, nothing else happened. And Khadija kept nagging him. "When are you going to have another one? When are you going to have another one? When are you going to have another one? Come on, it's about time. Come on, get another one. You got, you know." And she nagged the heck out of him. She totally fulfilled that proverb, you know, drip, 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 you know. And it just depressed him. I mean, he just got just so depressed and you know, so finally he decided he's going to end it all. So he climbs up on a mountain. He gets ready to throw himself off. And just as he was about to do that, another recitation came. And from that day on, he started preaching the streets. And his message was basically this: there is no God but Allah, and I am his messenger. Turn away from idol worshiping to escape the flames of hell. He began to preach this in the streets of Mecca. Khadija was the first to believe in him. Now, put your thinking caps on. Here was a town whose economy was based on religious tourism. And religious tourism was based on idol worship. And here's this guy preaching in the street against idol worship. What do you think the Chamber of Commerce thinks about him? they weren't too happy with Muhammad. And so they began to oppose him and all that. And he was surrounded by enemies. And it was in these days he was reaching out for you know, and all. And it just, people hated him. So things got bad, and they got worse, and they got worse, and they got worse, and they got worse. Well, eventually, some people from Medina had come down to Mecca on their annual pilgrimage, and they heard him recite these things, and they were so impressed, they said, "Oh, Rasul, prophet, we're impressed. Why don't you come and be our ruler in Medina? Because we got some disputes. We need a guy like you to solve our problems." So he said, "Well, I'll come on the one condition, that all of you folk become Muslim." Now, this is, he begins to use this term, Muslim. What does Muslim mean? Literally in Arabic, it means one who submits. Understood as one who submits to the will of Allah. And Islam literally means submission, or understood submission to the will of Allah. All right? You'll find Islam in Romans chapter 10. Remember? It's talking about the Jews. It says they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. You know, they did not They tried to establish their own righteousness, but did not submit to God's righteousness. There you go. That's the true submission, right? All right. Okay. All right. So they took it back, and people basically agreed. So they came back the next year, and they said, okay, we agree to your terms. He said, okay, one other thing. He said, I'll come if you give me your loyalty over your loyalty to your tribes and your families and all the rest of that. They said, okay, come. And so by that time, death threats have emerged. I mean, Muhammad is in some real trouble. So he and his followers decide to flee to Medina in ones and twos, and that is... reciting the name of thy Lord. That's the first verse, 610 AD. Okay, so they go to Medina, and he flees to Medina, and like I said, they're running scared in a sense. And so they get there. So this is called the migration, the Hijra. That happens in 622 AD, and the Muslims count that as year zero. Okay, so today we're in the 1420s, something like that. But now the Muslims use the lunar calendar, which is only 360 days, 355 days, whatever. All right, so he goes to Medina. Now, true enough, many of the people in Medina, the Medinans, became Muslim. But there was a large Jewish community there. And so he went to the Jews and said, hey, guys, I got good news. He says, I am the prophet mentioned in Deuteronomy 18. Okay. And the Jews said, oh no, you're not. Because it says he's going to be one of us, and you ain't one of us. And so Muhammad got mad. Now up to that point, he had been leading his followers to pray towards Jerusalem, and he leading them to do a lot of Jewish kind of things. Well, he got so angry that he said, enough of that. He totally wiped that out. He had his followers then start praying towards Mecca. And he hated the Jews from that day forward. Well, so all these people became Muslim except the Jews. And now, problem is, Medina didn't have that much industry. And people from the surrounding areas had become Muslim, and they wanted to hear him. You know, they came to sit at his feet. Well, how are you going to support these people? Now, when Jesus had that problem, you know, he just fed 5,000 with some loaves and fishes. Well, Muhammad didn't have those capabilities. So he said, how are we going to support ourselves? How are we going to support this community? Muhammad said, hey, I got it. I used to run caravans. And they were loaded with goods. Gold, silver, precious stones, you know, iPods, you know, whatever. And we used to run these things as a... why don't we rip off the caravans? Why don't we raid the caravans, you see? And so they thought if we raid the caravans, we could take the loot, kill the men, keep the women to ourselves. So they started ripping off the caravans. All right. So now the merchants of Mecca, you know, they're not going to take this thing lying down. They thought, oh, they got rid of Muhammad. But now he's starting to rip off their caravans. All right. So they decide they're going to put together a posse, you know, and they're going to come up and attack Muhammad. So from the next 3 years then, he has bloody battles with the merchants of Mecca from 624 to 627. Okay, I'll give you more about these battles in a second. But suffice it to say, the Muslims won the first one, the Meccans won the second one, the Muslims won the third one. And when the Muslims won the third one, it was such a great victory that the Meccans signed a peace treaty with Muhammad and allowed him and his followers to come to Mecca to worship, to make their pilgrimage. And what they did when they came to Mecca, they took over the Kaaba, smashed the idols, and made it the center of Islamic worship. Okay. Muhammad then, 3 weeks later, he returns. There it is. That happened in 630 AD, the triumph at Mecca. He returns in 3 weeks back to Medina, where he dies 2 years later. All right. So that's the thumbnail sketch of the life of Muhammad. Of course, you can read this. Now, let me say this. This is interesting about this. There are no sources of information about Muhammad whatsoever outside of Islamic sources. And this comes from the Al-Bukhari Hadith, which is, the Hadith is, Hadith means traditions, okay? It's the traditions of the Prophet. That's what they are. the Al-Bukhari Hadith. And so, but outside of Islamic sources, there's no information on Muhammad or any of this. All right. Now, real quick, then let's talk about the battles, those three battles of Muhammad. All right. So first is the Battle of Badr, March 15th, 624. Okay, this is the first of the battles. Okay. The Meccans numbered 1,000, the Muslims numbered 300, okay? So, what do you think the Muslims thought as they were getting ready to join this battle? That's exactly right. So they came to Muhammad and said, Rasul, we're going to lose, we can't fight. And Muhammad said, this is a jihad. Fight with all of your might. And if you die, you will go straight to paradise. This is the first time jihad was mentioned. And in this context, jihad meant bloody, physical war. Now, there are Muslims who will tell you, oh, jihad doesn't mean war. It just means I'm just going to fight for sin within me. Well, the Muslims have this concept of the greater jihad and the lesser jihad. The greater jihad is the sin within you, and the lesser jihad is the physical thing. But it does mean war, okay? Well, it helped that the Meccans were disorganized and without proper leadership, and the much better organized Muslims were victorious. The Muslims went in there, fought with all their might, and they won that battle, all right? Muhammad regarded this as Allah's deliverance of the Muslims, okay? That's the first of the battles. All right. The next was the Battle of Uhud. Battle of Uhud. That happens in, I think it's April. Is that right? Let's see. Yeah, March 21. That's right, the other one. The Battle of Uhud, 625 AD. All right. Now this time, the Meccans numbered 3,000. The Muslims numbered 700. Now the Muslims are outnumbered 4-1. Okay? And guess what? The battle was joined, the Muslims prevailed at first. But unfortunately, some of the Muslims abandoned their posts and began to loot the dead bodies of their enemies. And as a result of that, the Muslim lines collapsed, the Muslims were defeated, and of course Muhammad blamed the Muslims themselves for his defeat, and he called the Muslim trial for the Muslim sincerity. Okay? All right. The next was the battle of... Y'all ready? Next was the battle of Khandaq, or the battle of the ditch. And this is very important. You know, a lot of times people don't understand some symbolism that goes on in the Middle East. Okay, that's the one that was in April. April 6, 27. Now the Meccans number 10,000. The Muslims number 3,000. All right. Now, this third battle was largely waged through psyops. Y'all know what I mean by that? Psyops? Psychological warfare. This is a psychological warfare deal. Now, let me see if I can kind of break it down for you. Okay. One of Muhammad's converts was a Jewish guy named Abu Naim. Okay, Abu Naim. And now, Abu Naim was a secret follower of Muhammad. And so his fellow Jews didn't know it. So Abu Naim came to Muhammad and said, listen, I got an idea. He said, I can get your enemies to retreat without really getting the battle going. He said, I'll confuse the enemies. So this is what he did. He went to the Jews and said, listen, the Meccans have surrounded the city. Okay? So, the Meccans think that you are on Muhammad's side. So when the battle happens, they're going to kill you along with the Muslims. And you know, you don't like that old Muhammad, do you? Oh, no, we don't. We hate him. He said, okay, fine. Why don't you send them, I'll be your messenger, to go out to the Meccans to say that us Jews are not for Muhammad. but we don't want you to hurt us. So we want you as an earnest, you know, we want to sign a treaty with you, but as an earnest, we want you to send some of your key leaders to us as a guarantee that you won't attack us. And the Jews thought that was a reasonable plan. So Abu Naim then takes a message out to the Meccans surrounding the city. Now, in the meantime, Muhammad is digging a ditch around the city. That's what I call the Battle of the Ditch. Digging a ditch around the city. Now, he gets out there and he flips on him. He says, now listen, the Jews, you might think the Jews are not on Muhammad's side, but they're actually on Muhammad's side. And they're going to try to trick you into sending them some of your key leaders as an earnest because they want to make peace with you. Oh, by the way, Abu Naim said, send a messenger out. That's what it was. Send a messenger out with that information. And so what happened? Very soon, a messenger from the Jewish community comes out and relays the message. We're on your side. We want you to send some of our key leaders. So, of course, they said, oh, this is a trick. All right. So then that agitated that whole situation. And then Abu Naim then went over to the other tribes that were in the coalition. This is a coalition of tribes. And began to say, when the battle is joined, the Quraishis are going to take the loot and they're going to kill you. Oh no. And then he told the other ones that, the Quraishis is the opposite, you know, back and forth. And so what happened after all of this craziness, because the Muhammad's enemies became confused and fought among themselves, they abandoned their siege on Mecca. Now, the thing that really made them abandon their siege on Mecca was things were going bad anyway. And then a sandstorm came and blew all their tents away and everything. Okay. And that really psyched them. And then what Muhammad did, he took 600 Jewish men, and lined them up, lined them up along this ditch. And at his signal, and he said, Allahu Akbar! Slice! All their throats were sliced, and he threw them into the pit, and the blood ran deep and all that. And it was just a mess. And when that happened, that just totally psyched out the Meccans, and they abandoned the thing. By the way, whatever happened to the women, the wives and the children of those Jewish men, they became the slaves and concubines of the Muslims. So, they abandoned the siege. They signed a peace treaty with Muhammad, and thus the Muslims were victorious. And that's why, and by that time, what had happened, that most of these people who had been fighting against Muhammad then became Muslim because they saw that the Muslims were strong. So by the time Muhammad then comes into Mecca, his forces are 10,000 strong. Okay. Now something about the Muslim mentality about that. If you show yourself strong and tough and consistent, they'll go along with you. If you try to come off compassionate and all that kind of stuff, they'll take it as weakness. Okay? Anyway, I won't get into it. Okay, so that's that. Those are the battles of Muhammad. And that's a little bit of information about him. Okay. Now we're going to talk about leadership after Muhammad in a minute. Let's take a quick break. I know it's the after lunch time. I know it's tough, so I see some people nodding, and I don't want anybody to nod back and hit the wall or hit the floor or whatever. So take a quick break, 5 minutes, get the blood running and warm through your veins.